As bad as a springtime wave of COVID-19 might seem, I have worse news. A lot of people don't care. And to them, another wave is not a huge deal, despite doctors and medical professionals in the media increasingly sounding the alarm.
Ontario is hoping to put the brakes on surging COVID case numbers. Starting tomorrow, a province-wide shutdown will take effect. Meanwhile, Quebec has shut down schools and non-essential businesses in three cities. And in British Columbia, there's what's being called a three-week circuit breaker. Indoor dining is on hold, as are indoor fitness classes.
This is why, if you've been watching news or scrolling through social media, you've been seeing a Vancouver restaurant open up against restrictions. You're seeing packed malls and IKEA lineups in Ontario. And far beyond seeing some individuals making bad choices, you are seeing some governments treat this wave just like the last one. But it's not.
This arena is even quieter these days because COVID-19 has sidelined the Vancouver Canucks.
There's been a COVID-19 outbreak inside the team. As of yesterday, 16 players were in the league's COVID protocol. What makes it worse is that the Brazilian variant is in the dressing room. This thing is 2.5 times more contagious than the original.
The Vancouver Canucks, in case you don't care about hockey, have not been traveling to Brazil or to the United States. They've managed to have a COVID variant called P1 run wild through their locker room, canceling games and, according to reports, making some players seriously ill. And again, you don't have to care about hockey, but I will say this. Hockey players are fit. They have some of the world's best lung capacity. So if this P1 variant is knocking them down, maybe that should be the wake-up call. But let's recognize a few things here. Not everyone consumes every bit of news related to COVID and its variants. Not everyone, sadly, trusts the news they do hear. And not everyone can stay home. Not everyone can stay out of the malls, even if they wanted to. And not everyone has had it explained to them, simply and properly, why this wave is different from everything else that we've muddled through so far. So what are COVID variants? How do they work? How do we stop them? What do we need to do differently? Can we do it? And how fast? I'm Jordan Heath Rawlings. This is The Big Story. Another wave of COVID means another chance to talk to Dr. David Fisman. It's always a pleasure, even though I wish we didn't hear from you every couple months. How are you?
I'm well, thanks. How are you doing?
I'm doing okay. I'm doing about as well as I was doing this time last year. But we wanted to have you on to get some sort of explain some things to me like I'm five done here. And maybe you can just start because most people, I think, aren't on COVID-19 Twitter all day. Can you explain variants to me like I'm five? Like, what are they? What's happening here?
Sure. Well, I mean, you can go to the dog park and you can see beagles and you can see schnauzers and you can see, German shepherds. They're all dogs, right? They're all the same species. They can have babies. I mean, you can have a schnauzer, a German shepherd cross, but their genes are different. So they look different and they have certain characteristics that sort of may predict them behaving in certain ways. A German shepherd may have some attributes, the schnauzer may have others. They're living things. Viruses are sort of living things with an asterisk in that they need to appropriate the cellular machinery from a bigger, more evolutionarily advanced creature in order to propagate themselves. But, Their basic building blocks are still nucleic acids, are still genes that they use to make copies of themselves. And so this, you can think of these different lineages, which becomes a bit of an alphabet soup with P1 and B1351 and B117.
Right.
You can think of them as almost like the different dogs in the dog park. You probably would be less stressed out to get a bite from a Yorkshire Terrier than to get a bite from a German Shepherd.
Fair.
A German Shepherd may run faster than a Yorkshire Terrier, for example. So they're all dogs, but they have different attributes, even though they're the same species.
So lately, then, I've heard this phrase from a few people, and maybe you can help unpack it. It's that these variants make it a whole new pandemic. how does that happen?
I mean, sort of, but not really. What happens is that viruses are going to evolve. You know, we have influenza season every year, partly because that virus does what's called it drifts, it mutates. And indeed, sometimes it drifts enough that we come up with new names for flu virus strains. But what that does is, rather than people necessarily having to lose immunity over time, the virus changes enough that some people who were immune to last year's flu are no longer immune to this year's flu. So you see the same thing more or less happening now with coronaviruses, is that around the world, what's going on is something called convergent evolution, which is viruses in different places in Brazil or in South Africa or in the United States or what have you, that aren't descended from the same, you know, ancestors, are coming up with the same solution to problems. So, you know, we've got economies locked down, but schools are open. Can the virus take advantage of that, mutate in some way to take advantage of the open schools and spread in kids? And that may be part of what happened with B.1.1.7's emergence. But you see that same mutation, the mutation that made B.1.1.7 spread in the UK last fall, you see that same mutation popping up in South Africa and Brazil in totally unrelated viruses. Which tells you that's basically the virus's way of solving a problem. You know, maybe infection's getting a little bit harder because you're starting to exhaust hosts. Maybe the hosts that you've exhausted are mostly older people, but younger people are a little harder to infect by old variants. So maybe you mutate in a way that makes you better at infecting little kids, for example. And again, that may be the B.1.1.7 story with P1 and B.1.351 that people probably, I know we're not supposed to because we stigmatize places. You know, we're not supposed to talk about place names with these variants, but I think otherwise it's an alphabet soup for people. So, you know, the Brazilian, I'm going to call it the Brazilian variant and the South African variant. What you see there is that mutation, what's called N501Y, which is a mutation that makes the virus more infectious and also more deadly, in combination with something called E484K, which I like to think of as the EEK mutation, which seems to confer a little bit less cross immunity if people have been infected before. E484K lets the virus sort of escape from that prior immune response. And we see that in diminished, both in reinfection risk seems to be higher in Brazil. And we also see that in a little bit of diminished efficacy of some of the vaccines against E484K. Although the Pfizer vaccines, the Pfizer and Moderna, the mRNA vaccines, they seem to be every bit as good against these escape mutants as they were against the original variants. But with some of the other vaccines, the Novavax and Johnson & Johnson and AstraZeneca, they still have some effect, but it's diminished against these variants. So, you know, you can say, oh, that's a whole new pandemic. Well, it's not, because we also have, I think I've said this on your program before, what creates a pandemic isn't the bug, it's the widespread susceptibility to infection. And unfortunately, as we move through time and more people get immune experience with this virus by getting infected or ideally by getting vaccinated, that starts to deprive the epidemic of oxygen. And what's going to happen over time is it is going to subside. It is going to fade away. It is most likely going to turn into a seasonal disease that comes and goes, much like influenza does. You know, what it'll do over the long term is not clear, but that's very different from a pandemic. What we see with a pandemic right now, you know, there's this sort of canard that, oh, it's just the flu. Well, you know, that's just, you know, obviously bullshit. We don't build field hospitals during flu season. We don't have flu seasons that resurge in March and April. you know, it's all absolute nonsense. But in as much as this is a virulent little bug that we're going to get more and more immune experience against in the population, that is going to damp down the reproduction number. Little kids who are getting infected now, we worry that, you know, this may have some as yet unforeseen health effects in those kids. But from an immune point of view, those kids are going to have early life immune experience against SARS-CoV-2 that's going to protect them as they get older. So that creates a very different dynamic, you know, than a pandemic where everyone at all ages is susceptible at the outset.
That sounds really good for, you know, 3 months or 6 months or however many months down the road. But in terms of what we're seeing right now, I think the reason that we wanted to talk to someone who could speak to this is because I do think that there's this feeling, and I've felt it myself, that, you know, this is another wave of COVID. You know, we know what to do. We know what lockdowns we should have, and, you know, it will pass, and et cetera, et cetera. But then, you know, you didn't hear the intro to this show, but I spoke about the Vancouver Canucks, who now have 14, 15 players infected with this thing. There are some reports that some of them are seriously ill. And, you know, that doesn't sound to me like the past couple of waves. These are fit professional athletes and it's giving them trouble. Can you speak to what's going on in BC with P1 and what the danger is?
So P1 is one of these variants that both has the mutation that seems to make the disease more severe, more transmissible. That's the N501Y. And it also, and this is a reason to be concerned in Canada, has this EEK mutation that allows it to escape immunity from prior infection or from some vaccines. So the P1 variant is really concerning for all three of those reasons. I would contest your assertion that we haven't seen this before. I'm not sure if you remember a Canadian Broadway star named Nick Cordero, who died in New York during the first pandemic wave. Mm-hmm. You know, young, healthy guy in the prime of life, and he was killed by this. I think what this is that if you allow high attack rates, and the new variants make attack rates higher because the reproduction number is higher, independent of their increased virulence, which they also have, if you allow enough people to get infected, you're going to see uncommon severe outcomes. It's just, you know, it's just math.
Right.
If you have a 1 in 10,000 risk of severe illness or death in a younger person, and you allow, you know, 10,000 people to get infected, one of those people's going to die, right? Or, you know, the math's pretty unforgiving. So I don't actually think that this is that particularly surprising. I think, you know, the fact that they are younger folks and they are getting quite sick, the risk of that is clearly elevated with these new variants. We had a science brief that came out about 2 weeks ago that suggests somewhere around a 50% increase in risk of death, relative risk of death. So, you know, whatever your baseline risk of death is, you multiply that by 1.5, same increase in risk in hospitalization, and about a twofold increase in your ICU risk. And that doesn't change by age. So the absolute risks go down with age and go up quite profoundly as people get older. But the relative risk isn't modified by age. So it's not something that suddenly kicks in when you're 60. This is all the way across the age spectrum. So no, I think what you're seeing is you're seeing a degree of hubris where people have sort of ignored data that's been out there from the get-go. I mean, from China, we know that this kills young people too. And people have said, oh no, it's just folks in long-term care. Now we vaccinated them or what have you. You know, this has clearly been something that if you let it take off, that's going to kill people who would not otherwise be dying anytime soon. And I think that's unfortunately what we're seeing now.
The Big Story will be back in just a minute.
If we wanted to get a handle on the variants that are driving infections, I guess right now, let's say in BC and in Ontario and in Alberta, how would we change the response that we've used for the first couple of waves? What would we do differently that would perhaps do better against these kind of variants?
That's such a wonderful question. I mean, the fact is that we saw an explosion of B.1.1.7 about 6 weeks ago in Newfoundland, but they've had zero or one cases most days over the last 2 weeks. So these are eminently controllable, doing the same stuff that we should have been doing for older variants. The trick in a place like Ontario or British Columbia is you actually need to freaking do it.
Right.
So if you say we're going to control this by reducing contact patterns between individuals, you actually have to do that. And there are levers that you can pull to change how people interact. In Ontario, we've sort of got this nudge, nudge, wink, wink. We're all locked down, but going over to, you know, my relative's house for Easter and going to the mall for my very essential, you know, mall shopping and what have you, you know, if you're actually going to do this stuff, do it. And I don't actually tend to fault the population for this. It irritates me when I hear about some of the things that people are getting up to, because I know how badly this is hitting the ICUs now. But I think at the end of the day, a lot of the responsibility for this suboptimal state of affairs rests very much with government. That's given people mixed messages. That's clearly been quite ambivalent. That's given us messages like, oh, you know, we're not worried about not closing retail because we have ICU capacity. Well, what a messed up message that one is. We've got public health officials who 15 months in still aren't acknowledging basic features of the epidemiology of this disease that are actually the features that allow us to control it and that have allowed, you know, Atlantic Canada and New Zealand and Laos and Rwanda and, Korea, pick a country. There's a lot of countries that have controlled this. Australia's controlled it. You know, it's not about being an island. Laos and Rwanda are landlocked. It's not about having resources. Laos and Rwanda are poor. It's about actually using science to get the job done. And I mean, we still, to the best of my knowledge, we still in Ontario haven't ever had a clear articulation from our chief medical officer of health that the dominant mode of transmission of this disease is aerosol. And I think that's because that opens a whole can of worms in terms of costs and the need to invest in better respirators for healthcare workers and for others, and for the need to reduce class sizes and the need to work on ventilation in schools, all stuff that costs money. But if you continue to sort of encourage hygiene theater, you continue to say, oh, we can prevent this with deep cleaning and hand hygiene and plexiglass. Well, you're not going to do it, because that's not actually how this works at all. It troubles me so much that we wrote science briefs about this stuff. Stainey Brown was talking about this in press conferences weeks ago, that the finish line is in sight, but we have a minefield that we have to walk through before we get to the finish line. This was the minefield. And I mean, we're not just running through the minefield, we're freaking tap dancing in the minefield. And it's very, very distressing and frustrating to see. And, you know, one can do one's best to sort of raise awareness about this. But, at the end of the day, the government is calling the shots. And I haven't seen a lot of evidence that our current government is particularly motivated to use the tools in the toolbox that would really help us get this thing under control. It's very frustrating.
Yes. And if those things aren't going to be used properly, whether in Ontario or somewhere else, for whatever reason, leaving politics out of it, I guess what a lot of people, I think, turn to is vaccinations. And I've heard a number of people say, you know, we can't just vaccinate our way out of this. But similar to the other question I asked you, if if we were going to alter our vaccination strategy to do what would best counter the variants and the disease we're seeing now, how would we change it?
I don't think we would change it much. I think I think what we need to do is just do the stuff that's already on the books as being recommended by the science table, right? So a big source of death coming into 2021 was long-term care facilities. It was very important for those facilities to be vaccinated, and they are. And you see that in there's been this marked reduction in the daily death counts. The epidemiology of COVID in Ontario is really interesting, though. And it's a little bit nuanced, but we've been seeing this for a while. What we see is we ran the numbers recently because we wanted to get this right. So if we look at neighborhoods, at forward sortation areas in Ontario, that's the first three sort of alphanumeric characters of your postal code. What we see is that 70% of all the cases in Ontario come from 20% of those FSAs. So that's very, very localized. And there's dramatic differences in risk. And if you look within those FSAs, what's characteristic about them? A lot of them, these FSAs are lower income. You have a lot of people of color. You have a lot of new Canadians. You have a lot of folks who are engaged in essential work. You have a lot of multi-generational households. And what we think has been happening is that we have amplification of COVID in workplaces. And then you have younger adults bringing that home. And that then has been hitting older relatives. And they've been the ones winding up in intensive care. The shift with the variants is that now it's the younger adults too winding up in intensive care. And I think Stainey Brown articulated that in the recent press conference that we have multiple members of individual families. And I certainly saw that clinically during the earlier the first wave of COVID where you would have kind of husband-wife couples in the hospital, but they were both people in their 70s or in their 80s. What you're now seeing is sort of kind of multiple family members at different ages hospitalized simultaneously. So, this was on the books. One of the science briefs from a number of weeks ago now suggested a hybrid strategy where we vaccinate older people, but we really prioritize these hotspot forward sortation areas, these hotspot postal codes, and lead with that. And that's not about, there's this really ugly language that's out there that I've come across where folks will say, oh, that's not fair. You're giving it to these neighborhoods where people aren't following the rules, and that's why they're getting COVID. I mean, that's absolute bullshit again. What you have is you have neighborhoods where people are disadvantaged and are engaged in essential work and don't have the option of working remotely and don't have benefits, don't have paid sick leave, which is why many of us have been calling for paid sick leave for so long.
Well, I was saying to somebody that that it's the difference between people who want to go to IKEA and people who don't have a choice. They have to go to work at IKEA.
Absolutely. If you're engaged in retail therapy, this is not you. That would help us all because we all want to get back to normal as soon as possible. And we will. I mean, what you see is Israel, for example, is the most, I think, vaccinated country or one of the most vaccinated countries in the world at this point. It took them about 4 months to reach this point with really high levels of vaccination, kind of good electronic systems where they could track people down. They had some difficulties because of, I think, some religious communities within the country are a little bit less receptive to vaccination. This is not uncommonly the case. But at this point, Israel has effectively returned to a degree of normalcy. I think they're still actually keeping their schools closed for the moment, as kids aren't being vaccinated anytime real soon. But you see that this kind of full court press with one of the mRNA vaccines, which are our most effective vaccines, they got it done. It took them 4 months or so to actually really achieve these effects. And so in Canada, you know, we've got a bit more of a mixed bag in terms of vaccine efficacy, and we're vaccinating slower. And so we'll get there, but we'll get there slower.
This is my last question, and you kind of alluded to it a minute ago. You know, I think everybody has had in the back of their minds, like, the vaccines will come and this will be hard, but it will end, and it's a matter of a few months. And, you know, I always have had an image in my head of it being May and, you know, going up to a cottage or whatever, and whatever that impression of normalcy is. So I want to ask you, you know, when you picture, like, I can finally rest and, you know, I feel confident that the curve is coming down the way it did in Israel. Like, what are you picturing in your head, and when are you picturing it?
I think we're going to see very much a return to normal life. I think, I think the culture around mask wearing has changed. So, I just wonder, we've realized this year that flu season is optional, but I think we'll see very much a return to normalcy as before, except, you know, we're going to have this respiratory virus that maybe causes a significantly worse than normal sort of flu season, but it's still that sort of wintertime respiratory virus surge. I think this will remain a threat in shelters, in correctional facilities, in nursing homes, as many other infectious diseases do. What I don't hope that we see, although I think we might, is a huge investment in collecting virus species and doing all kinds of gain of function research on them, where you genetically manipulate viruses to see if you can make a really dangerous pathogen more transmissible. I think there's been concern for a good 10, 15 years now that we could create a pandemic that way. And whatever the origins of this particular pandemic, I think that hopefully we've learned enough from this experience that we realize that nature can create pandemic pathogens without an assist from us, and we don't need to be giving a helping hand with that kind of research.
I am going to close on that hopefully optimistic scenario, and let's not talk about the next pandemic just yet. Dr. Fisman, thank you so much for explaining this to us, as you always do, and I hope the third wave recedes, and the next time we talk to you, it's about something fun like mosquitoes again.
Inshallah. Thanks.
Dr. David Fisman, epidemiologist at the Dalhousie School of Public Health. That was The Big Story. For more, head to thebigstorypodcast.ca. Talk to us on Twitter at TheBigStoryFPN. Email us, TheBigStoryPodcast, all one word, all lowercase, at rci.rogers.com. You can find us in any podcast player. I hope you do. I hope you rate us. I hope you leave us a review and tell your friends. Thanks for listening. I'm Jordan Heath Rawlings. We'll talk tomorrow.